WNYC is supported by Cost of Living, the gripping new play by Martina Myoke. The New York Times raves, immensely haunting, adding tremendous emotion flows. The cast is as powerful as any now on a New York stage. A limited engagement at Manhattan Theater Club. For tickets, visit costoflivingplay.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Many, perhaps most of us in the United States take our right to vote as firmly established, even if we don't always exercise that right. But two centuries ago, in the years following the Revolution and the ratification of the Constitution, most Americans could not vote and had little say about their political representation. Their voting rights were won, sometimes after bitter struggle. Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU, examines that history and related political struggles in The Fight to Vote. It's published by Simon & Schuster. I'm very pleased he's brought Michael Waldman back to our show. Welcome back.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Historians and political scientists have talked about American amnesia. How we neglect our past successes of government or public policy. How well do we understand the history of voting or political representation?
You know, in some ways we understand it and revere it, and in some ways we don't really understand it at all. We're in the middle of all these fights right now over who can vote and how to vote and all these questions like that. And it turns out we've been having many of those very same fights from the very beginning. And there's an idea that we all know we didn't start as a democracy and it just sort of somehow got better since then, but it was always a brawl.
Well, people know that African-American slaves could vote, obviously, but when the Constitution was drafted in 1787, who could vote?
The only people who could vote at the time of the Revolution and the Constitution were white men who owned property.
So they're the only Americans who had a voice in ratification?
Yes, although when they, the kind of revolutionary ideals of the Revolution, which burst out every once in a while then, started to transform it right away. When Jefferson wrote the preamble to the Declaration of Independence, that's how the book starts, he talked about it being the case that only governments that rested on, quote, the consent of the governed were legitimate. And that began to kind of take on a life of its own. And they actually began to expand the franchise in some places even then, led by people like Ben Franklin.
Despite the rhetoric about no taxation without representation, voting rights weren't guaranteed. What was representation understood to mean then?
It's interesting. They fought about these issues a lot. Not so much who could vote, but what would representation be and how would the votes count? Back in England, they had what were called rotten boroughs. Basically, one lord's house would get a seat in Parliament, and the city of Birmingham would also get one seat in Parliament. And they said it was virtual representation. You didn't need to actually be represented. Fighting against that was a big part of what the revolutionaries thought they were fighting about.
Wasn't everybody a new citizen after we declared independence? Was any distinction made between people who had been born in the colonies and people who had arrived recently?
Well, when you look at the Constitution, even the question of whether you could be president, they had to have a sort of a start date because nobody was a citizen.
Well, and Hamilton, of course, had to be made as an exception.
And he was, And the United States did not have a fixed notion of citizenship and a federal national government notion of citizenship until the 1800s. Because if you think about it, we were desperate for people to come to our shores. We were desperate to have immigrants come in. A lot of the fights, again, over who could vote, it really started out with a question of whether just wealthy white men could do it. Then the very first real big victory for voting rights came in the period we know as Jacksonian democracy. And ironically, given the current political environment, it was angry white working class men who won the first voting rights victory.
John Randolph, a member of Congress in the early 1800s, said, "I am an aristocrat. I love liberty. I hate equality." Was that attitude common at that time?
It was uncommon to be expressed with quite as much, you know, tweet-like pithiness as that. There were a lot of villains, as I would see them, or people who were really nervous or resistant to the spread of democracy in America throughout the country's history, and I had not known about this guy, John Randolph. He was
George Mason is another one. Is that the Mason-Dixon line, Mason?
No, it's not that. Mason was an opponent of the Constitution, and he did write the Virginia Declaration of Rights, which became written into the preamble to our Declaration of Independence, and he opposed the Constitution but wanted a Bill of Rights. Mason was a more ambiguous hypocrite in those days. This guy Randolph came later, and he fought this, and there was a Virginia State Constitutional Convention where they debated whether to let people without property, white men, vote, and James Madison was there in his old age trying to expand the right to vote, but this aristocrat fought hard to stop it.
And aren't some of those issues still debated today, like the whole matter of taxation and regulation?
Well, you know, back then, the role of money in politics was about this question of could only the wealthy landowners run or serve or vote. That's kind of spread out in different ways. We have the campaign finance issue. We also have the longstanding things like the poll tax, which basically charged people money to be able to vote and was used in much of the country not just to keep African Americans from voting, but all poorer people, working class people. Now you have a lot of these new voting restrictions that, again, like a lot of these things, don't look discriminatory on their face, but they actually cost more money than the poll tax did if you want to try to actually pay it.
At one time, Louisiana posed 30 questions, including, I still can't believe that they would have done this, write every other word in the first line and print every third word in the same line, but capitalize the fifth word that you write. Could anybody pass that test?
I do that every day before breakfast. I don't know what anybody has a problem with that. So, you know, that one of the great American stories, of course, is after the Civil War, we did extend voting rights to black men, and there was a huge explosion of civic participation in the South.
The 15th Amendment.
The 15th Amendment, which was flawed and weak, but nonetheless, you had 90% voter participation rates among black men, for example, and electing hundreds of people to state legislatures and Congress and governorships. But then in the Jim Crow era, of course, after Reconstruction, that was revoked, and there was a reign of terror, really. And a lot of the rules that were put in place to suppress the black vote were not on their face racially discriminatory. There were literacy tests like what you just read. There were the
poll
tax. But
could white people pass that test?
Well, it was up to the discretion of the person giving the test. So, you know, somehow mysteriously, it wasn't really applied to white people. And that test that you just read from, that was from the 1950s. That was not from 200 years ago. This stuff, of course, continued very aggressively up until the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
Voting rights were extended to black men, not women, obviously, after the Civil War. Have other conflicts been followed by extensions of voting rights? I mean, have all voting rights been the result of struggle?
It's one of the interesting ways in which this question of who can vote interweaves with so many other things in the history of our country. It's when we have these big wars and when there's both the need for wider public support for a war, or a lot of people kind of earn their place by serving. So after the War of 1812, you had a lot of support for expanding it to working class white men. After the Civil War, by the end of the Civil War, 1 in 10 soldiers in the Union Army was an African-American man. And the idea was strongly held that they had earned the vote. Even the women, when women won the right to vote through the 19th Amendment, that took years of struggle, but it was helped by World War I when they went into the workforce. And the Vietnam War was most interesting in some funny ways because the voting age was lowered to 18, not because of gratitude to the Vietnam soldiers, because we know that that was much more controversial, but in the hope that giving the voting age to 18, giving younger people the right to vote, would keep them from rioting and demonstrating. And sort of it was like a kind of a generation gap solution.
My guest is Michael Waldman, whose latest book is The Right to Vote. Voting eligibility varied from state to state. So weren't some women allowed to vote in some states before they were given the franchisement by a constitutional amendment?
Yes. And again, it doesn't all the progress doesn't only go in one direction. There can be reverses, too. Women were eligible to vote in New Jersey at the beginning of the country's history. And
then Chris Christie became governor.
I was going to say, they shut the government down and look what happened. You know, they took it away in an early instance of fears of voter fraud. There'd been an election in Newark.
That doesn't sound like anything we would live through today.
Well, it was more picturesque in those days. What happened was people would dress up, men would dress up as women and go from county to county voting, allegedly. And so the legislature, hearing that possibly tall tale, did the natural thing and took the right to vote away from women rather than men dressing up as women. Of course, you did have in the late 1800s, early 1900s, a lot of the new states were more forward-looking and gave women the right to vote.
Like Wyoming.
Wyoming. They were leaving the old ways behind, and they also wanted settlers.
What about Native Americans? Were they treated as citizens?
Native Americans have not been treated as citizens and have continued to be shut out in many ways from a lot of the rights that others have. And again, not surprisingly, the history toward Native Americans has played out on the voting issue as well.
So what's the situation today? Is it a state-by-state situation?
Well, with all of these things, it's state-by-state. And there's a constitutional guarantee of the right to vote. This is one of the questions lawyers wrestle over. Is there a constitutional guarantee to the right to vote? I think there is. If you look in the original Constitution, it doesn't say there's a right to vote. But we have had all these amendments after the fact that talk about there being a right to vote.
If anything, the Constitution says that not everyone has the right to vote.
Well, back when they started it, you could only, first of all, vote for the House of Representatives. Senators were elected by state legislatures. And as we learned in 2000, there is no explicit right to vote for president because of the way the Electoral College works. But what we have seen occasionally, and this is partly where Native American voting rights have been protected or not, is the courts are willing to step in and say, yeah, there's a right to vote, and we don't want to do things that will burden it. But they haven't done it enough.
The Bush v. Gore decision states that, quote, the individual citizen has no federal constitutional right to vote for electors for the president of the United States. Would a narrow interpretation of the Constitution deny that we have a right to vote of any kind?
Well, that is one of these weird things that comes from having our Constitution written in 1787. We have the oldest democracy, but that doesn't necessarily always mean it's the best conceived democracy. A lot of the later countries that did it learned lessons from us. And the Electoral College, of course, is one of the things that we might rethink if we were doing it all over again. You don't have a right to vote for president, although that could be challenged now, too. And I would certainly say that, in fact, you do. But what we know, of course, is now multiple times, twice in the last 16 years, the winner of the popular vote lost the Electoral College.
And what have the courts been doing in recent years, especially with decisions like Citizens United and Shelby County versus Holder?
So for most of the country's history, and this was, again, something I learned about in doing the research, the historical research for the fight to vote, for most of the country's history, the courts really stayed out of the fight over voting and even over these other democracy rules. These fights were won in the streets. They were won in state legislatures, but the court not in the courts. Starting in the middle of the 20th century, you began to see the courts get more involved. Recently, in the last 10 years, there's been a wave of voter suppression laws, of new laws making it harder to vote for the first time since the Jim Crow era. And what's happened is, over and over again, the courts have actually blocked a lot of these laws. And it hasn't really mattered if it's a Democratic judge or a Republican judge or a state judge or a federal judge. The lower courts have basically come up with a consensus, which is that if there's bad motive, if there's malevolent intent, if it's racially discriminatory or even politically mischievous, states can't just do what they want. The problem is when these cases get to the U.S. Supreme Court, it's much more partisan and much more destructive. So you have Citizens United, You have Shelby County versus Holder, where the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act. And the worry that many of us have is that the Supreme Court, if it hears some of these new cases...
On voter ID laws.
Well, and on voter... So voter ID laws was interesting. The Supreme Court heard a case about 10 years ago where they did not strike down the voter ID law in Indiana. And a lot of people said, aha, see, they've upheld it. They didn't really do that. They just didn't have the facts at that moment. The lower court judge, a famous conservative judge named Richard Posner from Chicago, he had written the original opinion in that case saying, you know, this isn't voter suppression. Voter ID isn't a big deal. He's now changed his mind. He said, you know, these laws, the way they're written, it's not the problem is not voter ID. It's that they're written in a way to require ID that lots of people don't have. Posner, this leading conservative judge, now says, you know what, this is voter suppression. And he's actually reversed his view. So it's a big question of what the new Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch thinks what would happen if one of these cases gets up to the court.
My guest is Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU. His book, The Fight to Vote, is published by Simon & Schuster, and we'll continue a conversation after this. We are back with Michael Waldman, who is president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU. His latest book, The Fight to Vote, published by Simon & Schuster. If people, a great majority of the people living here were not given the right to vote, did people like Jefferson think that the free press would be the counterbalance?
They understood something like freedom of speech and the free press to be an important counterbalance, an important aspect of representation and of a meaningful republic. They also, and a lot of the other ways they saw the structure of government, checks and balances, as being the way you made sure that you didn't have tyranny. Now, Jefferson, interestingly, he wasn't in the country when they wrote the Constitution, but he did later on write that he thought it was a mistake not to have had expanded voting rights. But you had disagreements among the founders. Ben Franklin fought in Pennsylvania to end the property requirement. And when John Adams was writing the Constitution of Massachusetts at the same time, he was urged to do the same thing, and he was aghast. He said, there will be, women will demand a right to vote, and lads of 18.
He had a very strong wife. Did that not matter?
Well, you may remember there was a famous dialogue between them in their letters where she said, I hear you may be declaring independence. Don't forget the ladies. Mm. And she really basically was talking about this. Not about voting so much as about understanding that when you say all men are created equal, you don't just mean all men. So these debates went back a long way.
Now, moving up to the present, Russian meddling into our voting system is under investigation. Has anything else emerged from last year's election that raises concerns about voting and our political rights?
You know, in many, many ways, how we vote was fought hard, contested at issue in the last election. It wasn't just, as you recall, Donald Trump saying the election was rigged. You had the, I think, unprecedented level of foreign intervention in our election through the Russians. And we do not think they meddled with the voting machines. But we do know that they tried to get into the voter databases, and they broke in, we think, to the software manufacturers for the voting machines. But even beyond that, you had these new laws in some places. Courts struck them down, but in a place like Wisconsin, there were 300,000 people who didn't have the ID. Did that make a difference in that state? It might have, it might not have. And then, nonetheless, throughout it all, you had, for the first time, a major party candidate and eventually, rather remarkably, the president, claiming the election was rigged. And as soon as the election was over, as you know, he claimed he really had won the popular vote if you subtract the 3 to 5 million illegal voters, as he said. And now we've got a major investigation underway to try to prove his hallucinatory tweet.
But why do you think that 44 states and the District of Columbia are refusing to cooperate with Kris Kobach and that investigation?
It's, you know, it's an amazing story, and if future historians will write about it as another battle over voting. So to try to justify and try to prove his claim, Trump created a commission. In contrast to past commissions on voting that have looked at this, which have always been scrupulously bipartisan, this is chaired by Vice President Pence, a Republican, and Vice Chair, the guiding force behind it, is this guy, as you say, Kris Kobach, who is the Secretary of State of Kansas and one of the most energetic advocates for these restrictive voting laws in the country. And they've kind of stocked the commission with people. A guy named Hans von Spakovsky from the Heritage Foundation, who wrote a book claiming that there's massive voter fraud swinging elections, kind of snake oil salesman. And we think, I think, and a lot of people think, this is all to create a pretext, in effect, for more restrictive voting laws. But now they asked the states for the information. They sent out a letter saying, we want all the voter records for everybody, including their party affiliation, their voting history, and their Social Security number, last 4 years. And I think they didn't realize what a mistake they were making.
That's seen as an overreach even by Republican states.
The Secretary of State of Mississippi, who is a Republican, said, put out a written formal statement on the letterhead of the state of Mississippi saying, I have a recommendation for Kris Kobach and his commission. He can jump into the Gulf of Mississippi.
Allison Lundergan Grimes, Kentucky Secretary of State, said her state, quote, will not aid a commission that is at best a waste of taxpayer money and at worst an effort to legitimize voter suppression efforts across the country.
Well, and not surprisingly, and I realize this isn't the only area where this has happened, President Trump gave the game away in a tweet the other day. They called the Commission on Electoral Integrity, which is an important thing. I care a lot about electoral integrity, and among the things to care about, in fact, is the threat to electoral integrity of the Russian intervention, but other things, too. But he said he called it his Voter Fraud Commission, and it's designed to prove the existence of something that everybody who's looked at it says is not real, which is widespread, massive, illegal voting.
Just before the November's election, Wendy Weiser and Adam Gitlin from your Brennan Center were on our show, and they argued that rigging an election would be nearly impossible. Do we need to re-examine the issues concerning election rigging, or do we need to add to the discussion things like gerrymandering, voter ID, ballot access, security of digital voting machines?
The rigging that is something people worry about that really is really, really, really hard to do is the idea that you could flip the totals in voting machines so that somebody would win an election who wasn't supposed to win. And that's partly because the machines are not all connected to the internet, and increasingly they have security that makes it possible to know if that's happened. But the other ways in which, in effect, the rules are rigged or in the system has an outcome that doesn't give the voice of the people the full amplification, gerrymandering. You have all over the country, we've had gerrymandering from the very beginning, but it's gotten
named after Eldridge Gerry, who signed the Declaration of Independence?
He did, and he was a member of the Constitutional Convention. He was the governor of Massachusetts, who approved a legislative map that looked like a political cartoon of the time. Said it looked like a salamander, and they called it a gerrymander. James Madison, when he ran for Congress the very first time, Patrick Henry gerrymandered him, and tried to draw his district so he wouldn't get elected. So it's not a new thing, but the use of computers, and the fact that you've had a great deal of money and it poured into it, and partisan control by, in this case, the Republicans, although in the other times it's been the Democrats in the states, has meant we calculate that about 17 seats, for example, in the House of Representatives are Republican because of extreme maps.
My guest is Michael Waldman, whose latest book is The Fight to Vote, published by Simon & Schuster. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In Georgia, the Coalition for Good Government is suing over security problems in the state's electronic touchscreen voting system. They're calling into question this recent election.
I have not heard evidence that sounded particularly persuasive to me that the election, for example, in Georgia came out differently than the voters intended. But the worry that you have is that if you have touchscreen machines without a paper record, It's very hard to audit. It's very hard for the voters to know if their intention was accurately recorded. So we now know that if the Russians could mess with the voting machines, they probably would. And looking forward to 2018, this isn't over. This isn't, the Russians are coming back, and others too. And so whether it's voting machines, where there are a lot of things that can be done, whether it's voter registration databases, one of the things that's so crazy about what this Kobach Commission wanted was it wanted the states to send the information in an unsecured way that hackers would salivate over. After all the screaming about Hillary Clinton's emails, that seemed a rather ironic request. There are real reasons to be worried about election integrity, and we ought to take them seriously, but we ought to look at the real problems, which is not, you know, some imaginary busloads of invisible voters running around voting.
A listener asks what you feel about the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, which would get rid of the Electoral College.
So it's a really interesting idea. I think it's a good idea. I think,
but getting, unlikely.
Hard. The simplest straight line way to get rid of the Electoral College is a constitutional amendment, which has in the past almost happened on some occasions. But you actually can have this National Popular Vote Compact, which doesn't require an amendment. And what it is this: and if enough states say we will vote for whoever, we will have our electoral votes cast for whoever wins the national popular vote. If enough states do it, then you can almost make the Electoral College a vestigial organ. It wouldn't be without its complications, but it would give more people a reason to get out and vote.
Some states split their electoral votes percentage-wise. Wouldn't that have changed election results in a couple of instances?
Well, one of the responses that Republicans have had to complaints about the Electoral College is to say, well, what we ought to have is each congressional district should get one electoral vote, and whoever wins the congressional district would get the electoral vote. And there's two states now, Nebraska and Maine, they have two electoral votes, and they split it that way. It sounds like it might not be a bad idea on its face, but it actually would be a terrible idea because of gerrymandering and because we know that, more people are crowded together in cities, and there's a lot of more rural areas. And so that if you had just the congressional districts casting their vote, it would be really unfair and really tilted toward rural candidates, in effect, toward more conservative candidates.
On another front, Arizona's Senate voted to expand racketeering laws to include protesters and protest organizers. Aren't a number of states considering restrictions on protests and dissent?
We've seen a lot of these laws being considered, especially since the election. I think that this goes back to the question you asked about freedom of speech. We need to understand that what's at stake here is not just a technical question of this voting rule or that voting rule, but the future of constitutional liberal democracy in the United States and in the world. There is a real backlash to this. And so all the things that make that matter, whether it's the independence of the judiciary, which is under attack, or the ability to speak out against the government, which is increasingly under attack, or the unprecedented assault by the President of the United States on the news media, unthinkable in any other administration of any party. These are all also part of the fight for democracy.
Well, a recent poll indicated that the majority of Americans would believe CNN more than the president, but it's a very close I think it's 50 to 40 something. And then President Trump retweeted a doctored video that showed him wrestling CNN to the ground. Are views of journalism linked to attitudes about voting?
We are living through a period of tremendous polarization, of course, and partisanship. And it's not the only time in the country's history that we've had that. You know, most of the country in the 1700s and the 1800s, things were very, very partisan, and there was not an expectation of an objective news media. Of course, we also had the Civil War. It was a very violent time of class conflict and social conflict. One of the positive breakthroughs we've had is the realization that it helps to have facts that everyone can agree on. And when you look at things throughout American history, sure, there's been divisions of left and right, but sooner or later, people believed many of the same facts. And what's worrisome, of course, now is very few people trust in that. And Trump is working overtime to deepen this distrust.
Nancy McLean, who in her latest book, Democracy in Chains, argues that some billionaires like the Kochs and the Mercers, some other wealthy donors, know that they're in the minority in the United States. And she argues that they spend to circumvent democracy intentionally, actually based on the ideas of the late economist James Buchanan, who would want to dismantle our democratic institutions.
Well, there was a guy named Paul Weyrich, who I write about in the book, who at a very key early moment in our current political alignment was fairly explicit about this. He was an activist, a conservative activist. He was speaking in 1980 at the meeting where Ronald Reagan, having just won the Republican nomination, addressed the evangelical community, which was a very new thing. They had previously voted for Jimmy Carter, but now they were in the Reagan camp. And Weyrich was a warm-up speaker, and he said, I want to make it very clear. We don't want everyone to be able to vote. Our success goes down when more people vote. And it goes back to John Randolph of Roanoke saying, I'm an aristocrat. I believe in liberty and not in equality. This has been a strong strain throughout American history. And Paul Weyrich was not just an incendiary speaker. He started two organizations that your listeners possibly have heard of that are part of this fight now. The Heritage Foundation, which has been a major proponent of restrictive voting laws, and the organization ALEC, which lobbied state legislatures all over the country for voter ID laws and other things. So there's I would suggest, not reflective of the most powerful and positive ideals of America, but just an ugly part of our history.
Michael Waldman is president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, described as a nonpartisan law and policy institute. Now, some people might argue that you're not nonpartisan.
Well, we are nonpartisan, and these issues have, throughout much of our history, been at various times nonpartisan. On, for example, gerrymandering, Democrats do it just as much as Republicans do when they can, and we work with Governor Schwarzenegger and other Republicans to try to get redistricting reform. We represented John McCain in campaign finance litigation. Unfortunately, right now, it happens to be the case that a large part of the conservative movement and Republican Party has pushed these laws. But this week, I think, is perhaps a real breakthrough because they've so overdone it. They've so overshot the mark that you saw Republican elected officials pushing back. You saw when Trump claimed the elections were rigged, you saw Republican statewide elected officials, or the people who run elections like John Husted in Ohio, said, no, actually they're not rigged and there's not a lot of voter fraud. And I do think that this could lead to potentially more of a consensus, because there are a lot of things wrong with the way we run elections, and you could do a lot of things to fix them. The most significant would be automatic universal voter registration, which passed the Illinois legislature, for example, a couple of weeks ago unanimously. So out in the states, Republicans and Democrats are not being nearly as partisan, but at the high levels that you describe, it's much more of a concerted political strategy.
Michael Waldman's book is The Fight to Vote, published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you. My pleasure.